So hey, welcome back to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 90, with Vishal Shah. He is presenting at the 13th Annual Sports Medicine Update by Memorial Hermann. Again, the first half will be the live presentation. The second half will be the interview with Dr. Mark Knobloch and Dr. Josh Yellen. So he talks in there about Bo Jackson and avascular hip necrosis and some of the other things in there. So it's a lot of good conversation about hip injuries in athletes. So this, again, of course, I am the host, Jeremy Jackson, but doing most of the interviews for these sessions here, Dr. Knobloch and Dr. Yellen. And so I really appreciate all their help and the Masters of Athletic Training there at U of H. So also my coworker Bill Hell, he's doing a lot of running in between as well. Jasmine Dozal, Sarah Avina, both helping me out do these recordings here and making this possible. So sportsmedicinebroadcast.com during the school year. We should be almost every single Wednesday broadcasting live, so you can check that out on sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Subscribe in iTunes, rate it in iTunes, interact on Twitter, PHS SportsMed. Again, PHS SportsMed on Twitter, or hashtag TheSMB, and these things will help us interact and build the show. So listen to what Dr. Shah has to say, and check out the show notes for a link to his presentation.
Good morning again. My talk was going to be something in the hip arena, and obviously it's a big subject, so I try to focus on what could be the most useful or what could be useful. So today we're going to talk about acute hip injuries in athletes. So, you know, you see all kinds of hip injuries, chronic pain, strain, bursitis, tendonitis, and then there's a category of very acute injuries that you don't want to miss or that sometimes can be confused or subtly present initially, but if they're not identified and if the treatment's not initiated correctly fairly early in the process, you can actually have some catastrophic problems in the hip area. So we're going to hit on a couple of those hypotheses. So in general, we kind of broke these into acute and more insidious or chronic onset conditions. The acute onset conditions, and some of them are very obvious, of course. You've got hip dislocation, you can have your slipped capital femoral epiphysis, your skiffies, stress fractures, the hip pointers in contusion, thigh contusion, avulsion fractures, labrum tears, your muscle strains, quad, hamstrings, adductors, and then sometimes thrown in with the hip itself, because sometimes there's a lot of overlap and hard to tell initially what's going on. You've got your lumbar issues, lumbar strain, spasm. And then the chronic type things that we see in the hip area are going to be your bursitis, tendonitis. I mean, sometimes they can start acutely, but it's kind of a slower onset. Your impingement, hip impingement is a huge area. You could have a whole conference on just hip impingement itself. Sports hernias, osteitis pubis, snapping hip, and then lumbar disc herniation can also be acute or chronic. And then a lot of times, you know, these things can start looking like one of these slow onset, insidious onset conditions, but it can turn acute very quickly in terms of a stress fracture where you might think somebody has some bursitis or tendonitis, and before you know it, it turns into a spark. It really was a stress fracture all along. And it's critical to identify the difference in those things. The same thing with femoral impingement. You can have some chronic symptoms of joint pain with activity and so forth, and then it can acutely worsen into a labor tear at some point, and that's kind of what we want to, the distinction we want to make. So why are these important? Well, first we're going to talk about the most acute of the acute hip injuries, and I kind of picked these four, and we're going to talk about why those are important. So we've got hip dislocations and subluxations, the slip capital femoral epiphysis, stress fractures, and then femoral head and neck fractures. Obviously, those are all big injuries that you don't want to miss or delay treatment in. And the reason we don't want to delay treatment is the hip has a very tenuous blood supply. The blood supply comes in from the neck and then kind of goes backwards, retrograde up to the head. So any disruption between the head and neck can cause a lack of blood supply to the head, which can lead to a catastrophic problem of avascular necrosis or AVN. And that can also, either directly because of AVN or because of another insult, lead to chondrolysis, which is complete, or which is damage to the cartilage of the femoral head, and eventually that leads to an arthritic stiff and painful and troublesome joint that's very difficult to continue arthritic participation in. So we'll start with hip dislocations and subluxations. The most famous in the sports arena of these is probably Bo Jackson, and we've seen several instances since then. This was the actual play that ended Bo Jackson's career. And it didn't look like much when it happened. He walked off the field, but it led to avascular necrosis and ended his career. He never played another snap of football after this. And hip injury was simply a subluxation, not even a hip dislocation. In a hip dislocation, there's a fairly significant risk of avascular necrosis, 3 to 15%. In subluxations, it's much lower than that. And a lot of times, a hip subluxation never gets diagnosed. So what happened to him was quite unusual, but definitely impacted his career, and we see how severe a hip injury like this can be. So a true hip dislocation, the hip is completely out of socket. And the hip is a very constrained joint. Anatomically, it's a ball and socket joint. The strongest ligaments in the body, of course, surround the hip joint. And so it takes a good amount of trauma to get it out of place. It also takes a good amount of force to get it back into place. So typically, if you see somebody acutely with a hip dislocation, they've got this classic position where the hip is adducted, flexed, and internally rotated. And the difference between this and somebody who may have fractured their hip, you really can't reposition this patient's extremity. You can try, it's going to be excruciatingly painful. You can't really even log roll their hip out, their leg out to the side. So that's a telltale sign of a hip dislocation. They can't really be repositioned, and the pain is, you know, unimaginable. This really requires immediate transport for further sedation, further imaging first to confirm the diagnosis, and then further sedation to really achieve that reduction in most cases. This is what an X-ray on top would look like of a very clear hip dislocation here. You can tell the ball is clearly not concentrically in the socket, but they're not always that obvious. You can have a case where the femoral head is posterior to the socket, but it doesn't really look laterally displaced or medially displaced. And so in this case, if you take a quick glance, both sides look very symmetric. However, on this side, we look for something called Shenton's line. It's a line you draw right on this inferior neck, and you do that on both sides, and it should line up perfectly with the upper part of this foramen here. And on this side, if you do that same line, you can tell something's off. And so that's a posterior hip dislocation that needs to be overlooked radiographically. So even after you make the diagnosis and the sedation is administered and the hip is reduced, put back in place, you get more imaging, in addition to an X-ray, which will show now the restoration of that Shenton's line, you also usually do a CT scan. And the reason to do a CT scan is this is a high-energy injury, and it's usually not simply a soft tissue injury. There's often bony injury associated with it. And this would be a CAT scan of the patient's acetabulum here, femoral head here, and you can see there's a piece right here that just doesn't belong there. It's basically a loose body now. It was the posterior wall of the acetabulum. It should be right here. But when the hip dislocated posteriorly, it displaces and fractures this piece, and then when it's brought back in, this piece is now in the joint, and that's a huge problem. Left alone there, that would also destroy this patient's hip over time. And here's another angle of that look. The acetabulum there, the femoral head there, and this is the piece. So imaging after hip dislocation is critical. Sometimes if you have a patient or an athlete who's had hip dislocation and just isn't rehabbing on course or on par with what you expect, having pain, residual range of motion problems, and strength deficit, you know, it's very important that they've had this post-reduction imaging. A lot of times that doesn't happen. And so make sure we refer for that. Before we move on to Skippy, return to play after a fairly classic hip dislocation without fractures and retained loose body and things like of that nature is analogous to a shoulder dislocation, but kind of double the scale. This can take several weeks to become pain-free and functional again, but you do a same functional rehab of getting the pain under control, getting maybe motion back strength, and then functional goals. I would say typically somewhere in the 3 to 4 week range on the early time frame, and maybe a little longer in some patients. Now, split capital thermal antithesis is something that, again, you just don't want to miss. It can be subtle when you first see it, and it can progress to something very acute and traumatic by the end stage. This is something you're possibly going to see in a 13-year-old patient, usually a male 3-to-1 ratio of male to female commonality. Now, the condition itself is actually, I'm sorry, this is cut off just a bit, but the femoral head and the femoral neck are separated by a growth plate. And the growth plate is especially vulnerable in this age range, typically in more obese patients, and in certain ethnic groups it can also be slightly more common. The growth plate essentially is the weakest spot in this link, and the head will basically fall off the neck. In reality, the neck is what's probably moving, but the imaging and the evaluation, it really looks like the head has fallen off of the neck. And this would be an X-ray evaluation. This is the normal side here. If you look on this side, it looks like, kind of, they always say classically, the ice cream scoop has fallen off the toe. And this is a painful and very important injury to catch, because, again, if it's not treated correctly and in a timely manner, it can have a very high ABN or AVS or necrosis. So on exam, what these patients are going to complain of is usually groin pain. They're going to be limping, decreased hip internal rotation. On exam, it's pretty classic. The pain can often radiate to the knee. A lot of times they'll annulate with an externally rotating gait, because that takes some of the pressure off of that femoral neck, and it's a kind of an antalgic gait pattern, you see a lot. So usually be either limping or on crutches, and then two major classifications that these into, stable or unstable, depending on their ability to bear weight. If they can't bear weight at all, it's considered an unstable slip, and those have a much higher risk of ABN. The treatment for this, essentially, the immediate treatment is to take the weight off of the limb, and then to stabilize the slip. Essentially, we put some type of fixation, usually it's one single screw like this, across the growth plate here, to stabilize the position that the hip is in. We actually don't typically move the femoral head back onto the neck in most cases, because that can actually increase the trauma and increase the risk of avascular necrosis. So for most hips, most slips, we stabilize the position they're in. The goal is basically not to really fuse this growth plate, but to prevent further slippage. These patients, because the deformity is not corrected 100%, can often have some limitations still of internal rotation, but functionally most of them do well. The ones that don't are the ones that actually had quite a bit of deformity before fixation, and there's various treatments for them, osteotomy, where you actually rearrange the position of the bone and so forth. You also have to have a high index of suspicion of the other hip on a patient who's been treated or has a history of a skippy. There's about 25% chance of having this on the other hip. So if you have a patient who has this and they eventually complain of other side of hip pain, it's very important to take that seriously. If a patient presents with this and they're younger than 13, or it's an atypical thin patient rather than a heavier set patient, that's another thing that's a red flag, that there may be some endocrinologic disorders that are predisposing them to the slip, and they're very much a higher likelihood of having this on the other side. Next, femoral neck stress fractures. You know, this is something that you hear about and see frequently. Of course, it's another can't-miss scenario, because if it goes on to a full displaced fracture in the femoral neck in a young patient, that's a very big problem and a high risk of avascular necrosis. Symptoms are, of course, going to be groin pain, usually in the front of the groin, in that flexor crease, that area. Pain with rotation of the hip is classic. In the early presentation, it may subside with rest. You may find that the patient's pain is activity related, but as it progresses to more and more severity, even rest doesn't really resolve this pain initially. Typically associated with an increase or a change in training activity or endurance or distances, the amount of exertion, and usually they're complaining of increasing difficulty with bearing weight. The initial treatment, if you're suspecting this, of course, is to immediately stop the activity. If there's pain with just simple weight bearing and crunches, are important immediately to limit that. If there's to limit that painful gait, and then of course we do radiographs. And sometimes even the radiographs are negative initially. I think about 2, maybe 3 weeks. Sometimes we'll see any radiographic changes on an X-ray. So if you have a patient who's had this kind of hip pain, and they say they saw their doc and the X-ray is normal, it still could be a hip fracture. It's very important. I mean, it still could be a stress fracture. Very important to be diligent and suspicious and get further imaging if this is a concern. Bone scan is a cheaper test that can show this, but it's not as specific. So most of the time, these days we're doing an MRI because even if it's not a stress fracture, an MRI will hopefully pick up what else it might be. There's 2 types of stress fractures in the femoral neck. We've got the tension-sided and the compression-sided. The tension-sided stress fracture is shown here. It's very subtle, hard to tell, but there's just a little lucency right here on the upper side of the femoral neck. And that's a big problem because you can imagine the weight-bearing force is basically coming down on that neck and eventually can just snap that in half like a twig, kind of like a wishbone. On the other hand, the compression side fractures on the inferior lower side of the neck, and you can imagine there, axial load there is actually pushing the bones together. And so although it's painful, it's treated very differently. On a tension side of fracture, the treatment's going to be stabilization before it has a chance to become a complete displaced fracture. So the goal for this is early diagnosis and early treatment to prevent a full displaced fracture, which then can progress to AVM as a problem. So this is urgent surgical treatment with usually screws of this nature or there's other fixation devices. On the compression side fracture, it's basically rest to eliminate the stressful activity, whether it be the running or even just walking. You basically take them down a level from whatever is a stressful level. If it's pain with daily ambulation, you put them on crutches and don't put any weight on there. If it's pain only with running, you stop the running. But you do that for enough time until the pain goes away and then slowly reintroduce progressively increasing activities and increasing weight bearing and endurance. And any sign of pain, you slow down, take a step back, and continue to progress to that kind of course. Femoral head and neck fractures, actual femoral head and neck fractures, would be maybe after undiagnosed stress fracture, or usually it's not due to a stress fracture, it's going to be some pretty high-end trauma, high-energy trauma. There are different types based on where the fracture is, different classifications on the part of the head that's broken, or the part of the neck. And again, undiagnosed or delayed diagnosis really can increase the chance of AVM or anastomosis. These are usually going to be fairly obvious. You're not going to be able to weight bear at all on this type of injury. It's going to be acute pain in the groin. And a lot of times on this type of injury, as opposed to a hip dislocation where I said the position is going to be internal rotation with your hip adducted across your body, with a fracture, a lot of times the most comfortable position of rest is going to be external rotation, so that the hip is abducted and externally rotated. But on-field stabilization and transfer is going to be the course of action here. This would be an example of fixing a femoral head fracture. This is a fragment here of the femoral head. This can really be done typically through an open approach, although now we're getting a lot better at being able to do a lot of these things through an arthroscopic approach. If it's a fairly simple and accessible fracture pattern, this can be scoped and fixed in this manner with special screws that sit just below the cartilage surface. And it's important, of course, to restore the roundness or the sphericity of this femoral head to limit the long-term arthrosis of that joint. So that would be an example of fixing a femoral head fracture. On the other hand, the femoral neck fracture is right here. You see there's an asymmetric from the other side, just a fracture right across the neck here. And for this, you have to do a larger fixation device to really stabilize the head-neck junction. Again, it's critical to do this at a time point where you can prevent avascular necrosis. Now something we're going to go into the slightly less emergent type injuries. These are going to be things you'll see on a slightly more frequent basis, and they're important to treat correctly, of course, but we're getting away from now the things that can result in avascular necrosis. Avulsion fractures and esophageal injuries are very common in an adolescent type athletic population. Basically, they occur because the weak spot in this age group can sometimes be the growth plate instead of the muscle tendon junction where a lot of these other muscle injuries would occur. You can get them at various places around the pelvis. We'll go through a few of those in a moment. They present very similar to muscle strains. A lot of times they are the result of eccentric muscle contractions during athletic activities. Typically patients will feel or hear a pop, just like what they might tell you if they strain a muscle. The difference is really going to be where they hurt. They're going to hurt really right on the bone and at the very proximal origin of the muscle rather than at the muscle tendon junction where a lot of these other injuries will hurt. So it's very defined physical exam will really tell you what you're looking for here. So the most common one in this age, in the pediatric age group or adolescent age group, is going to be your anterior superior iliac spine avulsion right here, which would be a sartorius avulsion. Probably next most common is your rectus femoris avulsion at the inferior iliac spine. And the next ones are going to be iliac crest here, your abdominal muscles, and the lesser tuberosities or your hamstrings. I don't see this much in younger patients, but lesser trochanter iliopsoas tendon avulsions can occur also. Some quick examples of X-ray disease. This is a lesser tuberosity avulsion here. Ischial tuberosity avulsion here, indicative of a hamstring avulsion. This one is the anterior superior iliac spine, indicative of a sartorius avulsion. And then this one, very hard to see up here, but right there is the anterior inferior iliac spine, the rectus avulsion. The treatment for these is typically symptomatic, even though there's a fracture there. These fractures heal very well, and they heal relatively fast compared to long bone or other fractures. Initially start a protection phase, icing, anti-inflammatories as needed for pain, rest, crutches if they have an inability to bear weight on this, and then you're going to restore their passive range of motion and active range of motion, and finally strength and then functional activity. You can gradually progress them through their functional rehab and return them to activity when they're able to do their goals without pain. You're not necessarily waiting for radiographic healing as your endpoint. Generally, 4 to 8 weeks is sufficient depending on their activity level and age and the severity of it. When is it important to refer these patients for an X-ray? I would say if you feel, if there's bony tenderness, I would certainly refer them for an X-ray. In certain cases, depending on the degree of displacement, we do fix these fractures. Usually it's a high degree of displacement, 2 to 3 centimeters for most of these. Oftentimes what we'll see is even with a widely displaced fracture, initially the functional recovery occurs fairly uneventfully, but later on you can have problems from impingement from a displaced bony fragment and things along those lines. But even after somebody has recovered from one of these injuries, if they continue to have problems down the line, it still may be slightly related to this, and further evaluation may be warranted even after the fact. Hip pointers, hip contusions, usually not much of a diagnostic dilemma to diagnose this. You're going to get bony tenderness right over the crest of the iliac crest, basically the point of the iliac crest. You can see bruising, ecchymosis. It can be from a fall directly on that iliac prominence here. It can be from a helmet injury or a knee, various mechanisms. The treatment for this is again going to be symptomatic at first, crutches, icing, pain, relief, and then restore range of motion and strength and functional activity. When do you get an X-ray for this? Basically, they're going to hurt right over the iliac crest, but pain over the bony prominence isn't going to be necessarily your indication for X-ray. But if you feel if the pain is severe, out of proportion, if there's extensive bruising or ecchymosis, if they're not recovering appropriately over the first couple of days of treatment, or if you feel any crepitus or basically moving parts, moving bones there, then obviously that's going to be when you're going to want to do an X-ray. Return to sport is really when if there's no fracture, return to sport is really when they're comfortable and able to perform their athletic responsibilities in a safe manner. There's different kinds of tabs and everything available, of course, to help with that. There are some case reports some very low-level studies about doing these anesthetic and or corticosteroid injections. I don't think it would be recommended in most cases to do this sort of thing. There's extenuating circumstances sometimes where that discussion can be had with the patient on an individual basis and depending on the circumstance. But as far as mainstream care for these, it's not really something that's proven to be effective over the long term. Then we've got our rectus or quadriceps contusions, your dead leg injury. Again, it's a blunt impact of usually a knee or a helmet into the quadriceps muscle. It kind of sandwiches the muscle between the item and the patient's femur bone. You see them a lot in contact sports, and it can lead to a large amount of bleeding in that area. The thigh, anterior compartment of the femur there, or the thigh, I'm sorry, can hold a lot of blood, and sometimes this can really be a debilitating injury. The important thing here is to maintain range of motion. If you're given a chance to get stiff and painful, or given a chance to get stiff due to pain, they can really stiffen up and limit knee flexion over the course of the ensuing days after the injury. So it's recommended to maintain that range of motion early. A lot of times you'll immobilize them in the first 24-hour period in this kind of select position, even giving them crutches and letting them move around like this, because if they lose that range of motion early, it's very time-consuming and difficult to regain it, and it delays the overall recovery. So for significant injuries, this kind of immobilization is still done and recommended. For lesser degree injuries, pain control, ice, and the same modalities are recommended. And when range of motion and strength normalize, it's usually when we can get these patients back to their sport. Now, if somebody's had this injury and they're having a very hard time with their range of motion recovery, or pain is persisting, or you feel a palpable knot or a mass in the thigh, this injury has a very high rate of myositis occipitans, which is bony formation in the muscle. It's basically calcification of part of the muscle. And in the muscle, really, it's not part of the muscle, but it's usually differentiation of bone marrow cells and blood cells that can differentiate into these bony type elements. If that's the case, an x-ray is warranted, and you might see something like this. You see this kind of cloudy, ossified section here, and it's basically hematoma that turned into calcified bony type tissue. This can also slow recovery. It can be painful. It can be a difficult thing to rehab from. Typically, we still treat these symptomatically. Physical therapy, modalities, trying to regain their functional ability. If we just absolutely cannot, this calcification can actually be removed. But if you remove it too early, it has a high likelihood of recurring for the same reason that happened in the first place, trauma to that area, and surgery itself can be trauma to the area. So we try to wait until this bone is mature before we remove it, and that can sometimes take 6 to 12 months. We can do tests such as a bone scan to evaluate the maturity of this bone before resection. I'm going to just very quickly, hamstring, rectus, adductor strain. Those are very common injuries to see routinely, very common result of eccentric muscle contractions. This is going to be very similar to those of popliteal avulsion injuries, except these are going to be in the muscle tendon junction, but the mechanism and the treatment is very similar. You differentiate them from the avulsion fractures based on the location of the pain. You're not going to have the most acute pain right on the bony prominence. If there is, that's when you get a radiograph to differentiate. But I think we're all very well versed in the treatment and progression of these injuries. So for very high grade injuries with large muscle gaps, those are the rare injuries where sometimes the treatment is more than just functional, and surgical treatments to repair these muscles are just performed. We do that sometimes with adductors or hamstrings or even quad injuries. If there's high-grade injury with a muscle gap that's palpable, or the strength is just completely lacking, and you're not progressing on a normal expected course from a grade 1 or 2 injury, then further imaging with an MRI is warranted, and sometimes these injuries do be better if they're fixed. But those injuries are usually very clear. Finally, we're going to do quickly on labrum tears. Again, this is a huge evolving topic in sports medicine and in orthopedic surgery. You can do days and days on just the hip and hinge concept and labrum tears. But basically what this is, the labrum is a structure in the hip that surrounds the acetabulum, much like the glenoid in the shoulder. And what happens is the labrum can tear from either a subluxation or dislocation event, just like in the shoulder. But more commonly these days, we're seeing this as a result of some sort of mismatch between the ball and the socket. That can be from dysplasia, which was the developmental mismatch between the ball and socket, or from impingement, which may also be partly developmental. We don't know the exact causes of it, but it's a very subtle mismatch between the ball and socket, which in this case, as you see in this schematic, there's a little bit of overhang on the socket side, and this case also demonstrates a little bit of a bump on the femoral neck side right here. Now, what that leads to is in certain positions of hip flexion and internal rotation, you actually get pinching of the labrum right in this area. Here's a radiograph showing kind of a convexity here instead of a concavity, which you would normally see between the head and the neck. And this bump can impinge with a little bit of prominence here and pinch what would be labrum right in the middle. This is what an arthroscopic image of this would look like. The hip is distracted here, so we have a little room to work. There's the kind of the horizon of the femoral head. This is the acetabulum here. This structure here would be the labrum, and you can see how it's torn away from the interface with the acetabulum, and there's some cartilage injury here as well. This would be kind of a most likely something that had been going on for a long time, so sometimes it's a chronic problem with the hip impingement that then turns acute when the labrum tear becomes unstable. So we see this at different stages. A lot of people ask what causes this mismatch or impingement scenario. Why some patients have this bump here or prominence here? Has to do with development, we think. I'm not 100% sure. It's a difficult question to answer, but if you remember the slides about the PPU, the slip capital femoral epiphysis earlier, where the ball can slip just a little bit off of the neck, sometimes, or what one of the prevailing theories here is that's what ends up resulting in this. A very subtle, undiagnosed, or subclinical slip capital femoral epiphysis at a younger age that maybe occurs in a patient who wasn't so active at the time and never had symptoms from it. It actually goes on to heal on its own, but there's just a subtle slip here, and then with some remodeling and whatnot, you end up with a bony prominence here. So that's one of the theories. So the symptoms of a labrum tear, what you're going to see is basically the classic sign is a C sign. A patient will make C with their arm and kind of put it right there around their side of their hip and say, this is where it hurts. And it's not something that they can put their finger on, but it's kind of in between the two limbs of that C. They say it hurts right in there. And then they'll classically have mechanical symptoms as well, very often catching, snapping, locking, those type of things, although it depends on the type of tear. Sometimes it's just purely pain. The impingement test is this test here, where you flex, adduct, and internally rotate the hip. And typically what that'll do is it'll recreate the pinching between the femoral head and the acetabulum and pinch that labrum and reproduce the symptoms. It's not a super specific test for labrum tear, but most patients with labrum tears will have a positive finding here. Other hip pathologies can also cause this to be painful. The diagnosis to confirm, we typically do an MRI with a contrast injected into the hip. It's an MRI arthrogram. A regular MRI will miss maybe 60% of these injuries, and so it's typically done with dye unless it's a very high quality MRI. The treatment initially is non-operative. Sometimes with modalities and rest and strengthening the core and hip muscles, you can compensate okay for these injuries. However, for significant injuries, that typically is not the case. We do surgery for refractory cases and for mechanical symptoms. The important thing is, in this condition, slightly different than a shoulder, in some instances, you have to treat the underlying condition as well, which is in this case mostly impingement, not hip instability like a shoulder. So if you go in and treat these arthroscopically, this is that same picture we saw at first, you would clean up this labrum and make a repairable margin here, and then do some kind of suturation or repair physically to restore this. However, if you didn't take care of the osteophyte on that femoral neck here, indicated by that asterisk, and shave that down and make it a nice sphere that fits into the acetabulum there, the likelihood of recurrence of this problem is very high. So that's the important thing as far as treating the labrum repairs. You have to treat the impingement as well, whether it be on the femoral head side or the acetabular side. I think those are only slides I have. If there's any questions, I'm happy to field them at this time. Otherwise, we'll move on. Thanks for listening.
Great. Nice to meet you.
We're here with Dr. Shaw. I am Dr. Josh Yellen, Program Director for the Master of Athletic Training Program at the University of Houston. Across from me is Dr. Mark Knobloch, Clinical Coordinator for the Master of Athletic Training Program at the University of Houston. And to our respective left and rights is Dr. Vahal Shaw?
Michelle Shaw.
And Dr. Shaw, tell us a little bit about you.
I am a orthopedic surgeon practicing here in Sugarland at Richmond Bone and Joint Clinic, which is now part of UT Physicians, specializing in sports medicine. I really like sports and enjoy watching, as well as now treat people who are involved in athletics. And it's been I'm in the sixth year now of actual practice, so it's.
So tell us a little bit about, where did you go to undergraduate? Where did you go to medical school? Where did you do your internship, residency, and then your fellowship?
Sure, I did my, I grew up in Sugarland area in Houston, so went to UT Austin for my undergrad. I actually majored in business and did my pre-med courses at that time.
Uh-huh.
Then went to medical school at UT Southwestern in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And then I came back to Houston to do my residency in the medical center at UT Houston.
Okay.
And after 5 years there, did my fellowship in Birmingham, Alabama, and then back into Sugarland.
Birmingham, was that?
Yeah. We have to ask Birmingham every time you hear that name.
Is that with Andrews?
Yeah, so there's a big institute called the American Sports Medicine Institute, uh-huh. and Dr. Andrews, as well as Dr. Lemack, and several other doctors are part of that fellowship. So
right.
it was a very great experience for 1 year.
Tell us about that experience, right? So you're an orthopedic surgeon, you want to go into sports medicine. There are a few places that you can do a fellowship. One is the West Coast, where Dr. Lowe did it. One is actually now with Dr. Lowe. Here in
Absolutely.
Houston, one's over at the Cleveland Clinic, one is the Houston Clinic, right, and one's with Andrews. So tell us a little bit about that experience.
It was a great experience. Now, nowadays, there are actually probably, I would guess, 100 accredited sports medicine fellowship programs in the country. So there are
really?
Tons, and they're various sizes. Some have 1 to 2, 3 spots, and some have 12 to 15 spots. The bigger programs that you mentioned are definitely higher volume programs. So that's kind of the type of program that the Birmingham program is, and it's a truly eye-opening experience. You really practice hands-on sports medicine, which means being at the events on the field and seeing the evolution of the injuries from when they first happened to the recovery phase and the thing you really get there, which you don't get in, I would say, programs where you're not as hands-on, is really how to manage these events. I won't even call them injuries, because it's more than an injury; it's an event. It changes it changes the potentially the career of an athlete. It changes the outlook for a season, for a team. It changes what a coach has to do to prepare for the rest of that game or the next game. It affects the families of the players and athletes and the people around them. So I think that's where you take it from just the mechanical parts of the injury and the anatomical parts of the injury to really what the injury means on a broader scale.
You get to see the athletic training side of the injury.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about that transition, right? You're a business major in undergrad. You take your pre-med courses. So you really have no exposure to athletic training, probably until you get to your sports medicine fellowship.
True.
Is that right?
Yes, that's very true.
Okay, so tell us about some of the interactions with the athletic trainers and how you, tell us some of the things that you've learned along the way about the profession.
Well, the athletic trainers are the, you know, they obviously have a finger on the pulse of the athletes on the team, and they are they're essentially 24/7 in a lot of these cases. So, you know, it's very important to learn how to work with your athletic trainer. You can't do that without the actual hands-on experience. And,
right.
And so, you know, that's what I've found is really to trust and be able to communicate and work well with your athletic trainer. That was probably the most important kind of nugget of information that you take out of a fellowship, besides the obvious, the technical aspect.
Right.
And so when you're doing your fellowship over in Alabama, what kind of schools, I'm assuming you did high school, you did outreach,
sure,
college.
Sure, you did a little bit of everything. We, you know, tons of high schools. You know, Alabama's very similar, and maybe more so than Texas. You know, football is key there. So there's tons of high schools. You do work with those athletic trainers very closely. Personally, I was on the field with the Auburn Tigers. They weren't having one of their better years, but it was still an amazing experience. And so you see that level of it. I worked with Alabama State University as well. Occasionally would travel to the Redskins games and things like that as well.
So let's get into a little bit about, you did a lecture on hip, correct?
Correct.
And hip is really kind of a unique joint. It's a little bit like the shoulder, and it's a little bit about this. And I call the shoulder not a true ball and socket joint, right?
That's absolutely right.
And so, but the hip is a real true ball and socket joint.
True.
And so tell us a little bit about, from the anatomical standpoint, how you got interested in the hip, and what are some of the more unique injuries that we're going to see?
Yeah, the hip is definitely a joint that, you know, orthopedics in general, it probably was relatively ignored for a long time. Basically, in the hip, you had fractures, which were fairly obvious, and you had arthritis, which was also fairly obvious on an X-ray. And there, you would either fix the fracture or replace the hip, and everything in between was kind of chopped up into bursitis and tendonitis, and you know, kind of that unknown realm where we didn't really have an answer for it, so we didn't really know what to call it or how to treat it. Over the last probably 10 years, really, but even slightly before that, arthroscopy of the hip has become a possibility due to technical advancements and better cameras and a little better knowledge of the anatomy of the hip. And that's really opened the door to identifying a lot more pathology that was probably chalked up to, you know, aches and pains and arthritis, but was much more focal than that. And now that we've got the ability to use a scope and treat a lot of these injuries, it's really opened up a whole new world of orthopedic surgery, and which is arthroscopy of the hip, and specifically dealing with this hip impingement phenomenon. Also, we've been able to differentiate between hip impingements and sports hernias or abdominal hernias. These injuries have also become something that in the past were far undertreated because we didn't have the information.
You just didn't know what they were.
Didn't know what they were.
Right. So you're making the assumption that it's one thing, and in fact, it's another.
Sure.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, if I look at the glenohumeral joint as opposed to the hip joint, it goes through some similar motions, right? External rotation, internal rotation,
right.
And the external rotators, right? There are six external rotators of that hip. So tell us a little bit about your experience in treating external rotation issues in the hip, and why that's so important as opposed to some of the internal, because those internal rotators are big, right? Those adductors are big.
They're big. You generally have a greater range of external rotation than internal rotation, so you kind of have a more more functionally, the external rotators are more important in a way on a daily activity basis. You can actually get away functionally with less internal rotation than you can if you lose external rotation. The typical external rotation type injuries we would see are going to be things associated with your piriformis, and a lot of times that can also injure or aggravate your sciatic nerve.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the treatments for those types of injuries are going to be primarily rehab associated and functional and core strengthening. We do occasionally see acute external rotator tears. Even those usually are
from what? What do you see the acute external rotator pairs from?
You're going to see him usually in, it's not an extremely common injury, but you would see it in torque type injury, like a lot of times in soccer or hockey, where there's a significant torque or rotational moment on the planted hip.
And I'm sure you're probably going to take a little bit of piece of the labor.
Absolutely. So the soft tissue envelope has to be, when you have a damage to the soft tissue envelope and the hip is moved in a torqued in an abnormal manner, that's when you see the intra-articular injuries as well, flexor-stress labor.
You brought up an interesting term, the soft tissue envelope. Can you describe, some of our listeners are listening to this, they're getting some CUs off of this. Can you describe, what is the soft tissue envelope?
So soft tissue envelope starts with so you have the joint, the ball and socket, but everything around that is what I refer to as soft tissue envelope. The first layer would basically be your capsule of the joint, and that's composed of various thickenings, which are the ligaments of the hip. The strongest hip, the ligaments of your body are in the anterior portion of the hip, the iliofemoral and femoral ligaments. And then the posterior hip capsule is less of a main structure, but a very thick structure on its own. Outside of the capsule, you're going to start to have your deep muscle layers, the external rotators, the piriformis, the gemelli, and the obturator muscles. Posteriorly, and in the anterior portion of the hip, you don't have as many smaller muscles. You start to get into the rectus muscle and the sartorius, and those are kind of that would be what I would say the second layer of the hip. And then you've got your fat tissue and your skin. So that's kind of
the envelope. Let's go back to those external rotators real quick. You really brought up piriformis, but we know that there are five other external rotators. And so functionally, you brought up a really good term. Functionally, what does this do? We have more external rotation functionally than we do internal rotation. But if you really look at the anatomy, those adductors and internal rotators are enormous and big and strong. Yes. But those external rotators, functionally, we need them more. But they're so small. We see that a lot in the shoulder. We see that, obviously if I make the comparison of pectoralis major versus all the posterior musculature in the shoulder. So tell us a little bit more about functionally, what do the gemelli do? The gemellus brothers, besides being, they sound like they're part of the mafia,
yes,
right?
Yes, they sound like they're part of the mafia.
It's okay to say, hey, listen, I'm asked this question a lot. What do they do? And the right answer is, I don't know.
I personally don't know. And I don't know if we have all the electromyographic information to know. It may be out there. I certainly don't know on an individual level how those muscles differentiate themselves from each other.
It sounds like if there's an anatomist that is out there listening that can do some sort of testing to let us know exactly how this works functionally, please call in. So let's expand out a little bit. And talk about, further out. Let's talk about the gluteus minimus versus the gluteus medius. And then obviously, the big daddy, the gluteus maximus. So tell us a little bit more about hip movement and how the minimus, medius, and maximus work.
The medius and minimus work primarily as hip abductors, abductors. Mm-hmm. And they're very important. They're basically what we consider the rotator cuff of the hip. Just like the supraspinatus of the rotator cuff, is your primary abductor, if you will, or flexor as well as shoulder. Those are the primary, the gluteus medius and minimus are the primary abductors of your hip. They can actually get injured or torn, similar to a rotator cuff. We're seeing that injury more and again.
How would that happen?
A lot of times it's similar to a rotator cuff injury in an older patient. And when I say older, probably even in as early as your fifth, sixth, seventh decade, just from chronic overuse, or not even overuse, but chronic use.
Sure.
It's an area that has a less than optimal blood supply as time progresses, and you can end up with a tendinosis situation that ends up resulting in a kind of a attritional tear. So that's the most common way we see these abductor injuries. Sometimes it's from acute on a chronic situation where they might have some hip tendinosis and fall off.
The noise you hear in back of you is a little branding that we're having right now. Congratulations. So, there you go.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
Kind of one of the terms I've really heard come up in the last 7-8 years is this term sports hernia. And I think there's a lot of misconception about what it is versus a hernia. Could you just briefly talk little bit about sports hernias and what you see, what the prognosis is, and maybe their mechanism of action of how it happens as well, and what we need to know as athletic trainers in terms of treating them.
Sure. So a typical hernia, we'll start with that you would see, is not always an athletic injury. It can be it can just be a condition that patients can present with. It's truly a hole in the abdominal wall where a part of the intestine can actually herniate or push through. Even without the actual pushing through of part of the intestine, you can have that defect, and that's what a typical hernia would be. They can be in the abdominal wall or down in the inguinal region, lower in your groin. A sports hernia is more of a injury of the abdominal muscle attachments to the pelvic girdle, and there can also be a defect in the abdominal wall, but there's not usually it's not related to the GI system or to the intestines. It can cause pain in a similar area. Typically, the pain is more on the pubic symphysis or deep in the groin. The classic presentation of a sports hernia would be pain with a resisted crunch activity or pain with resisted adduction of the hip, and that pain is going to be not in the muscle itself, but more on the attachment or near the attachment of those muscles to the pubic wall, pubic symphysis. And the treatment is, or how you can get this is usually the most classic is going to be positions where you have to externally rotate your hip and extend your hip repeatedly. A lot of times we see that in soccer. We can see that in the football players who are backpedaling a lot or backtracking, typically in a secondary type position or cornerbacks and safeties probably have the highest incidence of this, although you do see it in other position groups. Treatment is initially, of course, conservative and you focus on core strengthening and rehabilitating and decreasing the pain first and then rehabilitating the core and the functional core strength. And if it's not successful, then they actually can do surgeries where you, depending on the, even sports hernia is a broad term, there's various different types and specific breakdowns within that. You can reattach the abdominal muscles to the pubic symphysis. Sometimes you augment them with different types of mesh if there's a weakness in the abdominal wall behind that muscle.
So you go back to conservative treatment of the sports hernia, right? And one of the things that pops up to me is that iliopsoas group. And I know that anybody that knows anything about anatomy, right, that iliopsoas has some stuff to do with hip flexion, some other things. Can you start to differentiate? How do you tell the difference between sports hernia, hip flexor, iliopsoas? Tell us some of the clinical diagnostic tests that you do to differentiate this with excluding MRI.
Sure. I mean, it can be very difficult. Clinically, well, first is listening to your patient and listening to the athlete and trying to see exactly what emotions cause the pain. That's going to be a big part of it. Is it going to be, and usually it's going to be certain things like kicking or even though the pain may not be from the hip flexor, it's going to be hip flexion activities that cause the pain, because part of hip flexion usually are contracting your abdominal muscles as well and flexing in that area. But physical exam is very important here, where if you have a patient lie flat on an examining table, first palpating where...
Prone or supine?
I usually start this with a supine examination. And you're going to palpate the area of tenderness. A hip flexor pain is usually going to be difficult to palpate on a bone, because the bony attachment of the hip flexor is kind of the iliacus bone or the lumbar spine. You can't really palpate that muscle organ very effectively. So their pain is going to be more with activity, but you can't put your finger on it. With a sports hernia, it's typically more symphyseal pain, pubic symphyseal pain, so you can palpate it a little bit more precisely, typically. The other thing I'll have them do is then, as far as examination goes, in the supine position, just have them do a straight leg raise. Typically, if they're doing that with their hip flexor alone, that doesn't usually incite as much pain. Or it can incite pain, but it's not going to be as specific or as reproducible as if you have them do a resistant crunch. So I find that to be probably one of the most differentiating exam techniques is having them do a resistant crunch, and that while you're palpating the symphysis.
And so resistant crunch, palpating symphysis is differential diagnosis for all those that are listening between trying to rule out iliopsoas, trying to rule out sports hernia, right? So
exactly.
They do a resistant crunch, you're trying to palpate pain. If you can put your finger right on, we know that it's probably not iliopsoas.
That's right. That's correct.
If it's one of those diffuse pain situations, we're probably going to rule out sports hernia, probably going to rule out hip flexor. I'm going to go towards iliopsoas. And so as you're looking at it as a physician, you're looking towards treatment. Tell us a little bit about that course of treatment.
For sports hernia?
Yeah, for sports hernia, for iliopsoas, for hip flexor.
So
what's kind of your mindset?
The mindset is typically, it depends partially on a course. The first thing you want to know is what have they already done with treatment, with respect to treatment? What have they already been through? Did they go through a kind of a home program of this is what I thought it was and this is what I got Googled and tried to do on my own, or did they have a supervised
Google knows all.
Did they have a supervised rehab program and were they consistent with that? So that's the first step, of course. And then depending on where they are in season and in their activity and in their career, quite frankly, that also influences how you treat these patients with respect to how much time do they have to try various things. But in general, you always approach things conservatively and see what you can do. You want to try to do the least invasive or dramatic thing to improve their symptoms. So you can start with equipment and activity modifications if that's feasible, resting from just to let the acuity of the injury decrease, using your regular icing and anti-inflammatories as needed, just to get the resting pain under control. Once you've got that under control, then you start to work on rehabilitation, which can mean a lot of things depending on the exact diagnosis. But I think in general, building core and hip and functional core strength is going to be key to both of those problems, really, the hip and the sports hernia. And then slowly trying to reintroduce their functional activities and seeing if you can have them compensate for this type of injury. Usually you don't truly heal a sports hernia. If it's a hip flexor tendonitis, that can calm down and heal. But a sports hernia simply doesn't heal. The question is, can you work around it or not?
So it sounds like, we've always learned about this kinetic chain, right? It's that old song, the hip bones connected to the whatever bone. And, but it really sounds like that hip joint is really based off, the success of that joint is really going to be based off, you brought this term up a few times, core strength. Mm-hmm. And being able to be, have your core stronger. For all those that are just learning about core, whether you're at the undergraduate level or maybe you're at the high school level listening to this, or you're just getting into athletic training or physical therapy, core, we've always been taught, is that area between, the base of your neck and your pelvis and everywhere in between, right? That's that core
exactly.
Of your body, and everything else is really an extremity.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah,
that's good. Okay. Any other questions for Dr. Shaw?
I do. I'm kind of curious. I did my postdoc at Baylor, and it was high genetic of work, and obviously, the majority of what you do is orthopedics. Are you seeing any trends from a non-orthopedic side, more of a genetic therapy or anything like that going on in your area? Or is it pretty much, would you say it's really manual therapy, surgery, whatever? Are you seeing any interesting things come out of stem cell therapy, that kind of stuff? Or what's going on in the hip area or whatever?
That's a good question. I guess a bottom line statement would probably be that's the future. For sure, it's going to be to figure out how to fix a lot of these things using stem cell therapy and genetic therapy. At this point in time, it's not refined or close to refined as much as it needs to be. And people are doing these treatments, and you see a lot of almost misinformation or exaggeration of the treatments that are available in the media and quite frankly, overseas there's not as regimented of a FDA regulation and so forth. And so, you know, even we see professional athletes in the news are going overseas to have quote unquote stem cell treatments.
And, you know, I don't mean to interrupt, but how do you handle that when you have an athlete or you have an individual come to you and say, or you hear about this in the media, they'll say, well, they let you do this in France, but the government doesn't want this to happen. They want us to go. How do you handle that as a physician to a patient saying, you know, it's not, I mean, we want you healed, and yes, you're going to hear this anecdotal evidence, well, the government knows there's a cure for your condition, but they just want you on medication. How do you approach the patient from that without, you know, getting a head-to-head battle going on?
It's a difficult question, because a lot of times, you know, patients want the quick fix, and shoot, if you know there's something available that is a quick fix, then you would demand it. You know, personally, you would want that. But I think you have to explain, and what I do is explain, you know, the reasoning. A lot of these things, you know, in this country we see, you know, we can't watch TV late at night without seeing a hip implant that's been recalled or a lawsuit that's from some pelvic mesh or something that was used. And, you know, I try to explain to the patients that that's the reason the FDA is so restrictive here on what you can and can't do, because, you know, you don't want to just have proof that it works in the short term. You really want to have that safety net that, you know, we've seen and observed the results of this type of procedure, implant, or what have you for many years, and we know that later on there's not going to be unforeseen adverse effects. And usually when you paint that picture to a patient and kind of put it in that perspective, they understand. You know, and there's pros and cons. I think with a lot of things you see being used overseas, you know, they're in vogue for a while and then they fall out of vogue or if they're proven to work, then eventually, you know, the proof is there and we see those treatments evolve over here. I think with stem cell therapy though, we're still a long ways off, even what they're getting across the pond, if you will. I tell patients as well that, you know, it still hasn't, they haven't cured arthritis using stem cells. They haven't been able to cure these injuries or treat or conditions that we're still treating over here. There are treatments that may help you in the short term, but there's equivalent treatments available here for most of those things with no added long-term difference. So at this point, it's not as difficult a conversation to have with a patient because I don't believe that the cure is out there at all. You know, if it was out there and not available here, that's a difficult
thing. There's a reason. There's a
then
reason.
Then I might tell them to buy a plane ticket. but at this point, I can confidently tell them that, you know, you're not missing out on anything right now.
That's outstanding. Any other questions for Dr. Shaw? Jasmine? Jasmine she's going to be a junior at Texas A&M. And in kinesiology, she's thinking about applying to our University of Houston Master of Athletic Training program that we just started up. I have a not so smart question for her, not like Dr. Knobloch, you know. I was really lucky to find this guy. But something that's been sitting in my mind now for probably 20 years. How do you differentiate between adductor brevis and pectinus?
Adductor brevis.
Because that pectinus is just that small little adductor,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
Dr. Brevis is
my
there.
Question to that question would be, practically, does it matter? But I mean, it's a good question.
Why are you asking me a stupid question?
Did
you see his facial look? It was like, why are you asking this stupid question? This makes no sense at all. No, I'm just joking. Listen, Dr. Shaw, we want to thank you very much. I'm sure you got to get back to the clinic and see a bunch of patients there. I'll probably wait for you. And you said that you were over at Richmond Bone and Joint that's been picked up by Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine. You're working with UT physicians, right?
Exactly.
And so you're in Dr. Lowe's group.
That's right.
That's right. And Dr. Lowe has become a partner with us for our University of Houston Master of Athletic Training program. And if you go to our website, www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT, click on the link that says partnerships, scroll on down, and you're going to see that we've affiliated with UT Health Science Center and their Department of Orthopedics. Click on that link, and I'm sure you'll be able to find Dr. Shaw through one of those links. If somebody's got a question for you regarding hip, how would they be able to contact you? Can they email you? Is there a website they can go to?
Absolutely. They should have on the website you mentioned, actually, UT Physicians. There should be contact information that can get to me. I'm also on Twitter at sportsdocshaw.
Sportsdocshaw.
Just SPORTSDOCSHAH.
Yeah, great.
And I have a website, sportsdocshaw.com. There's plenty of ways to get over me.
So you have Twitter at sportsdocshaw, and then you have a website called sportsdocshaw.com.
Correct.
Great.
I put some useful information on there.
Yeah.
You can ask questions, those kind of things.
Well, that's the wave of the future.
Yeah, yeah, it's nice to interact with the patients that way. It's funny, once you start having that exposure, you almost get a different type of patient sometimes that finds you just from those avenues that you know may not have found from the conventional ones. So.
It's all about marketing and promotion.
Yeah, and that's where the business background may come
in. That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. Well, Dr. Shaw, thank you very much for myself and Dr. Mark Knobloch. Dr. Shaw, I'm Dr. Josh Yellen, and thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
All right. We'll be right back.